book, the Song of Encouragement will be number 294.
Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. I had something else planned, and I wound up changing directions this evening. I tend to talk a lot more about following than about leading. I find following to be a much more practical issue than leading. But leadership is an important issue and needs to be dealt with. And I've been doing a lot of study and reading up on the subject. So I thought I might share some thoughts with you centered around one of the best examples of leadership that I know. Not all examples are positive examples. And I'm personally persuaded that Saul is given to us and given to Israel in the book of 1 Samuel almost specifically so that we will know how not to be leaders. This is man's idea of what a king looks like. Well, you get your fill of that, and then I'm going to show you a real king who may not have been exactly what you were looking for. We're not going to talk about him today, but we will talk a little bit about Saul. Before we do that, I'd like to share a story with you that I heard about a man who visited officers' candidate school for the Marines in somewhere in Virginia. I think Eric would know where it is. He may have been there. I don't know. But anyway, he's visiting the Marine Corps, and the fellow who's the commandant is late, and he comes to him finally afterward, and he says, "I'm really sorry about that. I'm never late for things. But we had an issue." "Well, what was it?" "Well, actually, we're dealing with this fella, and it looks like we're going to have to drum him out of the Corps." "Oh, that's a shame. What's going on?" "Well, it turns out he fell asleep on guard duty." Now, let me emphasize something to you. He fell asleep on guard duty in Virginia. Didn't fall asleep on guard duty in Iraq. He didn't fall asleep on guard duty in Afghanistan or at Guantanamo Bay. He was in Virginia. That seemed a little extreme to this fella, and he said so. And he said, "Well, it's not just that. We have another fella. He's in the brig right now. He also fell asleep on guard duty. He's going to be disciplined. He's going to be fine. This fella's different. This fella, when we called him on falling asleep, he denied it. And then after that, he denied it again. And he kept denying it until he was confronted with irrefutable, incontrovertible evidence, at which point he said he was going to take full and complete responsibility for his actions." He said, "In the Marine Corps, we take responsibility when we're guilty, not when we're caught." And that kind of stuck with me. That's a good policy, I think. Maybe the Marines have the right idea as far as that sort of thing goes. Being a leader, if you're going to be a leader of men, whether it's Marines or your own personal family or the Lord's church, if you're going to be in a position of leadership, you have to be prepared to take responsibility for your choices, for your actions, including and particularly the bad ones, because we're all going to have bad ones, and grow from them and hopefully help others grow as well. Saul didn't do that. Saul did a few good things, especially toward the beginning of his tour as king, but not always. Saul is an example of what the biologists call the alpha male. We've kind of taken that terminology for humans, but usually originally it was talking about animals. That there's a particular animal that rises to the front of the pride of lions or the pack of hyenas or whatever. And he exhibits all these leadership characteristics. And it works for the tribe. It works for the group. And human beings have been cataloged as doing the same sort of thing. That an alpha male is going to come to the fore in some social setting and take most of the food and take the best of the women and that sort of thing. And the tribe goes along with it because they believe that this is their leader and he is going to take care of them. Now, that does not always happen. And when we say leaders go first, usually what we're talking about, or lots of times anyway, what we're talking about, is they get the first pick of everything. And sometimes that's the case. We see that in the corporate world. We see that in the political world. And sometimes we see that in families, even. there is this tendency to think that because you're in charge, that means you get to do whatever you want to do. That's not really what I mean here. When I say leaders go first, I'm simply saying that leaders go first. That's why they're leaders, because they are leading. And as often as not, they are leading into bad situations or dangerous situations rather than leading into positive sort of situations. Leaders are supposed to lead. And Saul didn't always do that. There's a story given to us in 1 Samuel chapter 17, and we alluded to it, I believe, in the morning service, of this giant named Goliath, who was threatening the people. And we back up a little bit to chapter 13, shortly after Saul, the first real negative chapter for Saul in the book of 1 Samuel. And we find out that in the middle part of the section there, that the Israelites did not have any metalsmiths. They didn't have any iron workers at all. They had, if they wanted to sharpen their plow, they had to go to the Philistines and pay them to do it. The Philistines had it set up that way. Partly it was a way of making money and keeping the Israelites in check. But mostly it was because of warfare. They realized they had a technological advantage over the Israelites. They wanted to keep it. As a result, whatever kind of iron weaponry might have fallen to the Israelites was just captured in war and immediately went to the king. Saul and Jonathan appear to be the only ones who had a sword. And when we turn to chapter 17 in the Goliath story, we find that Saul is willing to let David use his armor, which tells us that Saul had armor too. Well, that's significant. And it's important. If anybody is supposed to have a sword, if anyone's supposed to have armor, it's going to be the king. Because the king needs to be protected, because the king is the most important person in the field, everybody is looking to him for leadership. You need to protect the king. You need to make sure that the king is okay. All that's fine as long as the king is doing his job. Now, we read before from chapter 8 and verse number 20, not verse 22, it was in, well, let's see, chapter 8 and verse number 20, that the people didn't want to listen to Samuel, right? They want the king. So Samuel is telling them that what's going to be like with the king. And we know this is the case. We can look at the political climate. We can look at royal families all over the world throughout history. We know that this happens, that kings take the best from the people. And the people are usually okay with that because the assumption is the king is going to act like a king when you really need him to act like a king. And they describe what the king does in verse number 20, that the king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. That is very significant. Hone in on that phrase there. Why are we going to let the king have the sword? Why are we going to let the king have the armor? Because at some point in the future, we know we're going to need somebody to go out and fight. And we want the king to go out and do that. And that's the great unasked and unanswered question in 1 Samuel chapter 17. Goliath challenges the people of God to send out a champion to fight him in one-on-one combat. That is exactly why the Israelites wanted a king. And yet Saul does not go forward. Saul does not challenge Goliath. And it's not difficult to figure out why. Because he's afraid. Well, who wouldn't be afraid under these circumstances? But the fact is, leaders go first. Leaders go into battle. Leaders go into difficult situations. And sometimes they get hurt. And sometimes they get killed. But nevertheless, this is the price. You want to eat at the front of the line for, I think Saul was king for 32 years, close to 40 years. You want to be the big man on campus all that time? There's going to come a time when you're going to have to pay for that. Are you going to be willing to do that? Now, we criticize our politicians all the time. We criticize our business leaders all the time for being perfectly willing to cash the big checks, for being perfectly willing to take all the accolades and get buildings named after them and look like the big important people. But when it comes time to cut costs, they're nowhere to be found. In fact, oftentimes, you know, maybe this is remembering some headlines to your mind from not too distant past, when business leaders put thousands of people out of work and in so doing earn themselves $20 million payouts. How do we feel about that? How do you think their employees felt about that? Probably not too crazy about that, right? But we understand why. They were put in position of leadership and they sacrificed the people so that they could survive and so that they could prosper. It's exactly the opposite of what leaders are supposed to do. We are okay. We love honoring our leaders. We throw parades for them. We put them up on a pedestal. We want them to succeed. We want them to be outstanding. And we don't mind paying them the big checks. We don't mind encouraging them and putting their pictures on posters. We love that stuff. But we expect them to act like leaders when the time comes. And when they don't, that is a grievous disappointment. This is true for elders. We can see this in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse number 17 and following, that elders are counted worthy of double honor, the text says, in the local church. That may have to do with financial payment, in some situations at least. Especially when they're working as preachers as well. Which brings up the idea of preachers, by the way. These leaders in the Lord's church, leading people who tend to be very much go-along, get-along kind of people, very supportive people, not troublemakers, not war makers, they're in position, if they want, to exploit the situation. And we have entire sections of the Old Testament given to Ezekiel chapter 34 comes immediately to mind. The shepherds that are fleecing the sheep, literally, taking as much as they can out of the flock and offering nothing in return. That's not spiritual leadership. Preachers are supposed to be in the same kind of position here. It's okay to, and I'm on the record with this. I've said this many times. I'm totally okay with preachers getting paid for what they do. I'm a big supporter of the concept. The Apostle Paul was too. Wasn't always appropriate. He didn't always do it. I haven't either. But it is appropriate for it to work this way. But if you're going to do that, then you need to be a warrior for the Lord. You need to be a leader, a spiritual leader of people, of Christians. Timothy is exhorted in chapter 2 of 2 Timothy, verse number 2 and 3. The things which you've heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Suffer hardship with me, verse number 3, as a good soldier of Christ Jesus. No soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier. Verse number 4 especially there. There are situations that come up when the elders or the preachers are asked to do something that's unfortunate, difficult, expensive, whatever. And because of the position that they're in, they're expected to do it. Now, hopefully we can serve as examples so that other people can chime in as well. But they're not going to if leadership doesn't show the way. And so the people who are driving the bus, as it were, need to be pointing in the right direction. Act honorably always, instead of just acting for your own personal benefit. Leaders also make rules. Leaders are the ones who set up the way that things are going to operate. Well, who else is going to, after all? And that's true in the local church as well. It's true for Saul. Saul is well chastised for a rather ridiculous rule that he came up with. And it's noteworthy that in 1 Samuel chapter 14, we're specifically told that Saul takes this battle personally. He says that he wants vengeance, personal vengeance, against the Philistines. Now, exactly where he got that attitude, not quite sure. That's not the right attitude for a king of God's people. This is not personal. This is national. This is serving God. This is serving the nation. This is not about Saul. Nevertheless, he takes it personally. And he puts all of the army under a vow. He says, no one is allowed to eat until I've had my vengeance upon these people. Well, word didn't get down to his son Jonathan, who's apparently the only other one in the army that has a sword, and presumably knows how to use it well. He's the king, the heir apparent to the throne. Saul certainly is grooming him for the throne. Jonathan didn't hear about this vow, and so he finds some wild honey and he eats it because he's hungry. And he feels revitalized. Well, why wouldn't he? And then he hears about this vow. Well, now Jonathan's going to have to die. And suddenly Saul is in a very difficult position here. He's compromised in his leadership. He's going to either kill his son, which obviously he doesn't want to do, or he's going to have to renege on this promise that he's made. Break his own rule, which he winds up doing, and I hate to think that I'd ever be in his position, but I think I'd probably do what Saul did in this position. I can't imagine killing my son over something like this. And the nation doesn't want him to do it either. Well, why was Saul in this place in the first place? Because he made up a silly rule. Because he didn't know what he was doing, as far as this sort of thing goes. Not only that, but it also put the people in position to sin. Once they finally find some food on the hoof, they kill it and they eat it. They don't properly bleed it. And so therefore, defile themselves, sin against the Lord, which upsets Saul. So, no, we can't do that. We have to slaughter the meat properly. And he sets it up right. Well, they wouldn't have been in that situation in the first place if Saul had not been capricious in his passing down of these rules. Likewise, we also, as we look to our spiritual leaders, we have to make sure that they are above reproach. That's the first thing that's mentioned in 1 Timothy chapter 3 with regard to the description of an elder. The first thing, they're above reproach. They're going to be people who can be reliable in situations like this. They're going to make good decisions. They are trustworthy with regard to such things as this. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse number 2 and 3 talks about their behavior as shepherds under the chief shepherd. That they are supposed to be selfless and holy and righteous, putting God first in their behavior. Peter writes here that they're supposed to shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those who appointed to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. This is not about you. This is not about the individual. This is about serving some greater good. A spiritual good, instead of just scratching our own back, as it were. I'll give you another example here. Leaders are going to establish boundaries. There are proper places for, well, let me put it this way. Some people belong and some people don't belong. If the leadership of a local church is brought into contact with a prospective member, what do we do? Well, it depends somewhat on the local leadership, but some exercise of oversight needs to be shown here. Just because somebody comes off the street and says, hey, I'm a Christian, I want to be a member of the church here. Well, says who? You know, maybe this person is a liar. Maybe they're a troublemaker. Maybe they are sowing seeds of discord. Maybe they're a government plant for some kind of lawsuit against such and such for so and so. You know, you hear about these kind of things happening all the time, or that they're going to happen one of these days. Leaders have the obligation of setting out boundaries. These are the people who will be involved. These are the people who will not be involved. And the most practical application of this is with regard to discipline, with regard to the people who are in the church. What are we going to do about this wayward soul? What are we going to do about this rebellious one? What about this false teacher? Well, the elders have to take control of this and decide certain people belong, certain people do not belong, and exercise proper oversight in these situations. With Saul, most of his problems centered around David. And you know the story. 1 Samuel chapter 18 describes how David fell out of favor with Saul. And it wasn't because David was a bad man or a bad servant, a bad warrior. Very much the opposite, in fact. He was a little bit too good. And Saul became jealous of him. We've heard the song that the women were singing there, verse number 7 of chapter 18. Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Well, that's not a bad thing. Maybe it was sung to mock Saul. I don't know. It's real easy for us to criticize Saul, I suppose. But what the attitude that he should have taken is, if David is winning these tremendous battles, if David is being this huge force for righteousness, that's a good thing. And I want David on my side. Well, as it turns out, Saul didn't want David on his side. In fact, he was trying to kill David at various times because he was jealous and because he was afraid that perhaps he would lose his throne to David, which eventually, of course, he did. It gets rather gruesome, and we'll spare the glorious details of this. But in chapter 22... we see that Saul, because of his fear of David, because of his jealousy, is moved to slaughter 85 priests at the priestly center of Nob. What could 85 priests have done to offend Saul so badly? Well, I'll tell you what they did. They fed a hungry man. Or at least some of them did. Supposedly, some of them did. That seems a little bit extreme. Well, it seems extreme to me too. And in fact, it seemed extreme to most of Saul's people. He had to find Doeg the Edomite, who apparently is one of the all-time great bad guys, and one of the great bad guy names, by the way. Doeg the Edomite. You just got to love that, right? I'll do it. To get in good with the king, sure, I'll slaughter peace. I'm glad to do it. And he does. Well, that's not such a great thing, is it? Is that spiritual leadership? Is that taking responsibility? Is that putting first things first? No, he's trying to preserve his kingdom. As he said to Jonathan back in chapter 20, verse number 30 and 31, this is your kingdom I'm fighting for, Saul says. Jonathan's going to be the king, the next king. And David is a contender. And remember, Saul is in a very precarious situation. There's no uniform nationwide understanding that Saul is going to be the king for the rest of his life, and after that, his son's going to be king. This is an experiment. This is all new to the people of God. And the most natural thing in the world would be for some pretender to come up and say, I'm stronger than Saul. I'm certainly stronger than Saul's son. I ought to be the king. And David seems to be setting himself up for that sort of thing. At least in Saul's paranoid mind, he is. That's not what David's trying to do. But, nevertheless, Saul thinks that is what he's trying to do. And so, therefore, he excludes somebody that he ought to be including. Fellowship should be about preserving our mutual connection to Jesus rather than pursuing our own personal agendas, getting what we want out of things. In Acts chapter 20, verses 29 and 30, the text there describes Paul's encounter with his brethren, his friends from Ephesus. These are elders in the church, and he is warning them about the times to come. Among various other things, he says in verse number 29, I know that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock, and will from among your own selves, men will arise, speaking perverse things to draw away the disciples after them. Now, what are you going to do about this? He says you're going to be on the alert in verse number 31 and going on. Try to make sure that you take care of business. Make sure that you have first things first. You're not pursuing your own personal agendas to the detriment of the work that God has given you to do. As Saul did, we need to make sure that we are serving God appropriately, trusting these noble leaders to lead us in the right sort of direction. Appointing elders is a fearsome task. And we should do it very, very cautiously. Make sure that it is done with some prayer, study, obviously. And I like to think that the brethren here took the business very seriously back in the day when we appointed elders here. The reason that you take time, the reason that you choose appropriately, is because these men are going to be leading, and you have to make sure that they're leading properly. In chapter 13 of Hebrews, verse 17, a text that we refer to a lot in this context, he says, obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this will be unprofitable for you. Showing honor to such ones is a good thing. And when they put themselves in position to lead in the proper way, it makes it a little bit easier for us. And we're going to have a gospel meeting not too long. And I'll take the opportunity to thank the brethren again, a few years late. But nevertheless, thank you for the way that I've been treated, and especially the way that I was treated when I first met the group here, and when the group invited me for a gospel meeting after I was already here. I thought that was kind of interesting and enjoyable. And I loved how I was treated like the visiting preacher when I was here. And of course, I'm talking about food. Let's cut to the chase. I'm talking about food. And we're going to wrap things up here in a second. I went a little bit over this morning, but I'll try to give you some time back tonight. But we give honor to these ones who give themselves to us, who give themselves to the work. And that's why churches traditionally have fed preachers and in other ways entertained preachers in these sort of situations. It's because of the task that they've taken upon themselves. And I want to speak a little bit on Brother Emerson's behalf. He's a fine man and a fine preacher, and he's going to do good work for us here. And I encourage you ahead of time to find ways to show him honor. To find not just food, although you can do that. He'll appreciate that. He's a preacher, after all. But to extend honor, not to the individual, but to the office. I'll close with this other story. Not a military story. The story goes that there is an undersecretary, a former undersecretary in some department. I'm fuzzy on the details of the story, forgive me. But he's lecturing at a symposium of some sort. And he is in front of the group, and, you know, hundreds of people in the audience. And he's got a styrofoam cup of coffee in front of him. And he's lecturing, he's getting his notes, and he's drinking his coffee. And he stops in the middle of his presentation, and he looks at his cup. I wish I had a prop here. He looks at his styrofoam cup. He says, "You know, a year ago, I was in this same spot. I was speaking to the same group. But I wasn't the former undersecretary at that time. I was the undersecretary. The administration was still in place. I was still serving in this very important position. I flew here business class. Somebody met me at the airport, took me in a car to my hotel where I was already checked in. They took me to my room, made sure I was taken care of. In the morning, this morning I woke up, I came downstairs, there was another car. That morning, rather. There was another car. It took me to the venue. They went back to the private entrance. I was ushered personally to the green room where I was taken care of. And they offered me a cup of coffee in this beautiful ceramic mug. It was great. I'm not the undersecretary anymore, he says. I flew here coach. Nobody greeted me at the airport. I took a cab to the hotel. I showed myself up to the room after I checked myself in. This morning, he says, I got another cab. I came to the venue on my own. I walked through the front door. Nobody escorted me. I found my own way to the green room. When I got there, I said, is there any coffee? One of the guys said, and pointed to the percolator over in the corner, where I went and poured myself a cup of coffee in this styrofoam cup. He says, I suddenly realized, it's not about me. It's about the office. I am not worth the ceramic mug. The office is worth the ceramic mug. I'm not the undersecretary anymore. I'm the styrofoam cup. That's me. And that really kind of stuck with me a little bit here. I trust that I've heard Brother Emerson preach many times, and I'm confident that he's going to do a fine job. But we don't show him honor because he's a great preacher. We show him honor because he's a preacher. Because he's given his life to working for the Lord, and he's given this week to working for us. That deserves honor. And so we need to show him that honor. That's probably the extent of my remarks that I'm going to give with regard to preparing yourselves for the gospel meeting. But I hope that you'll be able to be here and to participate and to grow from the experience, because I know that I will. And I trust that you will if you're going to be here as well. And lead others in that regard as well. We're going to offer you an invitation to come to the Lord this very evening. Jesus is calling to you that you come. If there is some need that you have, if you need to make your life right with God in some way, if you need to be baptized in water for remission of sins, there's no point in waiting for the gospel meeting. You can do it tonight. You can do this very hour, being ushered into the family of God by being baptized in water in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sin. If this is your need, or if in anything else we can help you in a spiritual way, please respond to the invitation while we stand and sing at this time.